Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. This is Doug Sciocca. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Kavar Capital. And tonight I'll be joined by Tom Bowling, our Executive VP and Financial Planning Czar, and John Nagel, our Chief Investment Officer. We're pleased to have the chance to check in with some clients this evening and really want to begin by thanking you for your trust and your confidence in our team. Tom, John, and I have each prepared some remarks about various aspects and influences of the economy and financial markets. And once we conclude the prepared remarks, we'll spend as much time as necessary on Q&A. Right now, all callers are muted. When the Q&A begins, if you do have an interest in asking a question, please press *9. And that will alert our switchboard. Tom will then elicit the question by reading off the telephone number from which you have dialed in order to preserve your anonymity. So let's get started. 2020 was nothing short of an incredible year, and I mean that from most all perspectives, human, economic, medical, and emotional. As in most years, we learned many new things. Yet, 2020's education possessed the quality of being more consequential than an average year. The global healthcare system and the global economy were stress tested like never before, exacerbated by their synchronicity. Comparing a catastrophic set of circumstances to events of 100 years prior seemed very silly at the outset, only to prove pretty appropriate as the year unfolded. We experienced the best of society in innovation, collaboration, and conscientiousness, and the worst of society in economic disequilibrium and pitched partisanship. John will talk in deeper detail about the specific capital market performance in 2020 and thus far this year. But to consider the depths of market decline that we underwent, the recovery and its speed are nothing short of head snapping. We have to credit, in large part, the interventions of the Federal Reserve Bank, the prior Congress, and the Treasury Secretary for galvanizing most all resources at their disposal for the purposes of stabilizing the financial system. And while it may sound cretin to center on the economic aspects of a catastrophe that maligned all areas of our existence, the interconnectivity of and the interdependence on a fully functional free market offers the proven best path for the restoration and elevation of living standards entitled to all people everywhere. The pandemic has offered the opportunity for permanent and positive change in the global economy, as only in undergoing something so cataclysmic can the status quo truly be shattered. To that end, we are in the midst of monumental changes in drug development and life sciences. We are in the throes of a financial technology, also known as fintech, revolution. We are experiencing a parabolic world flattening courtesy of the incorporation of technology in all areas of communication and commerce. It is a very exciting time. We spent a lot of time at Kavar Capital thinking about the potential and the limitations of such significant forces of change and do our best to be anticipatory of their impacts. Certain things are easier to foresee than others. The lift in interest rates that has catalyzed the market volatility of the last few weeks was an invariable byproduct of the high amount of government spending that is coinciding with an economy that is reopening. And while higher interest rates can adversely impact stock prices, there is a continuum along which they can be productively existing before becoming problematic. We feel that we are in the positive phase of an interest rate adjustment right now for three reasons. Number one, a steeper yield curve, which is really just a fancy way of saying that the cost of money is higher in the future than it is today, is beneficial for banks. Banks make money by borrowing at a low rate and lending it out at a less low rate. That is known as a positive net interest margin, and the existence of which is an important signal for the health of the financial system. Number two, savings rates are improving. How many of us are frustrated or annoyed when we see how little interest we're able to earn in savings accounts and on CDs? An upward adjustment in interest rates provides access to a more palatable cash flow stream without taking higher than desirable risks to achieve it. Number three, and lastly, constructive pricing power in the form of modest inflation is positive. It is a sign of healthy demand. As the world economy awakes from hibernation, it is with an expectation that spending will rise, consumption will elevate, and demands for goods and services will rebound. The steepest part of that recovery curve will be at the beginning, when demand could outstrip supply and modestly put upward pressure on prices. For publicly traded companies, this may increase their profitability, reduce the multiples of earnings upon which their shares are valued, and ultimately make them more attractive. So while a lift in interest rates certainly seems logical, the social media-driven short squeezing in companies like GameStop and AMC that captured the minds and imaginations of day traders everywhere was less easy to expect, and certainly less easy to understand. We had a client who was unable to be on tonight's call send in a question about this specifically, so I'll go into more detail a bit during the Q&A. But suffice it to say, it is dangerous to underestimate the power of techno-fueled groupthink, and it is important to be reminded that stock trading is no longer the sole domain of the career investor or the investment advisory firm. It is accessible by anyone with a good Wi-Fi connection and a good idea, be that incubated personally or through communication with a subset of like-minded cohorts. The activity that we have witnessed in this regard requires an expansion of the type of analysis that we undertake. It incorporates inputs that previously played very little into our range of prospective outcomes. Having your stock trading head on the proverbial swivel is ever more critical in this day and age. So at the same time, we remind ourselves that while each year of investing possesses its own unique markings, nuances, and conflicts, and each feels at that time as though it is incurring in isolation, it is merely a fiber contributing to the fabric of the market, which blankets the historical context within which we make decisions and allocate your capital. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to John Nagel for a deeper dive into last year's performance metrics and to bring everyone up to speed on some identifiable undercurrents that have begun to define 2021.
Thanks, Doug. There's going to be a lot of this time last year anecdotes going around the next few weeks as we're getting close to the time last year when COVID really started to impact daily life here in the U.S. and the markets. As we know, markets peaked about a year and 2 weeks ago on February 19th before the downturn that intensified in March. This date, March 3rd, last year was a memorable day. It was the first day of the first emergency 50 basis point rate cut by the Fed. Markets were already down over 10% from their highs, but this quickly turned into an all-out crash within the next 3 weeks. Rather than rehash all the events of the crash and recovery during 2020 on this call, we'll focus on the investment takeaways we identified from the year as a whole. We highlighted these in the recent investment note we sent out. Number one, the market is not the economy, and the market is not necessarily the stocks you own. The point here is twofold. One, to explain why the market recovered so strongly and quickly, and how the S&P 500 ended one of the most economically devastating years in memory with an 18% return. And two, to note the extremely narrow leadership we saw for the bulk of the year. The first point hits on one of the most frequently asked questions by clients during 2020, which is why is the market going up given all that is going on? The simple answer is that the market is driven by companies uniquely set up to not only manage the pandemic, but in some cases take advantage of new opportunities and thrive. E-commerce, for example, or the companies that help to seamlessly work from home. The hardest hit areas of the economy in this crisis are barely represented in public markets. And this is all not to mention the periods of social unrest and extremely turbulent election that the market seemingly whistled past. After the initial risk-off period of March, investors seem to realize that work from home is doable and that the most heavily weighted companies are going to actually have strong years, even in the midst of COVID. There's obviously more to the answer as to why the market rose in 2020. Fiscal and monetary stimulus were massive for one, but market composition is a key component. Second point is that the market, and this is the market as we know as the headline number we see daily, was carried by the performance of the top five companies, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, better known as Google, and Facebook. These five stocks, at their peak, made up nearly 25% of the S&P 500 in September of 2020, a record weight for the top five companies. The five stocks averaged a 53% return during the year. We discussed on our call at the end of summer but this top heaviness was approaching unhealthy levels, and we were looking for some broadening out of the market to sustain the rally. And we did get that in a big way. And it really gave the market another leg up as everything surged together to end the year. The second takeaway is an old but very simple investment adage that took on new meaning in 2020. Don't fight the Fed. The Fed threw everything we thought they had in their arsenal at the crisis. Then they created some new measures and threw those at it. 2020 changed the way we think about monetary policy going forward. By bringing rates to zero again, the Fed reinstated two conditions that support rising equity prices. Low zero and negative real interest rates create a powerful incentive to own stocks over bonds. And two, a simple finance principle. If you're discounting future cash flows, this ultra-low discount rate raises the asset's net present value. In addition, the Fed essentially backstopped credit markets with new secondary market programs. Credit markets were undoubtedly freezing up and in trouble. Margin calls were happening. These were completely new steps for the Fed, but just the idea that they could step in by throwing the kitchen sink at the problem, they calmed fears and reinvigorated investor risk appetite. The takeaway here is that there doesn't appear to be limits to what the Fed is willing to do in times of crisis to maintain economic and market stability. The third investment takeaway from 2020 is an easy one to grasp in calm times, but extremely difficult to apply for investors when markets get panicky. In 2020, simple strategies like rebalancing and dollar cost averaging rewarded investors that were willing and able to withstand volatility. Historically, the best days of a cycle happen near the worst days, and the strategy of holding before, during, and after the lows of a market cycle give an investor the opportunity to capture what has historically been the best days in the market. Thinking back on our experiences in 2020, I don't know of anybody that effectively timed being in and out of the market. It was truly chaos at the lows. It's still not clear why the market bottomed on March 23rd, but the takeaway is to focus on time in the market, not timing the market. So those are three of many takeaways from 2020. Those three really resonated with us to keep top of mind as we go into 2021. Now moving on to more current developments in the market. And this is kind of tied into what we talked about in the first takeaway. The market was too top heavy and needed some broadening out, both to the rest of the large caps and also to bring along the small cap companies in our view. We've certainly gotten that breadth. From the start of the fourth quarter last year to Tuesday's close this week, small cap companies, the Russell 2000, have outperformed large cap companies, the S&P 500, by over 30%. Now, a lot of that was a catch up from underperforming for the first 9 months of 2020, but small caps actually ended up catching and then passing large caps for the year. This was the first year since 2016 that small caps beat large caps. We also see the rotation in the equal-weighted S&P 500 versus the standard market cap-weighted S&P 500 index. In the market cap-weighted index, the one that is universally followed, the largest companies get the largest weights and have outsized influence on the index performance. In the equal-weighted version, each of the 500 companies gets the same weighting and have the same influence on index performance. This is a great way to measure the breadth of the market, whether or not the whole market is participating or just the select few at the top. From Q4 2020 through Tuesday, equal weighted has outperformed market cap weighted by nearly 11%. So far in the first 2 months of 2021, equal weight is up by nearly 4% over market cap weighted. Equal weight hasn't outperformed market cap weighted since 2016 as well. And finally, the much-discussed growth-to-value rotation. So far this year, investors have rotated out of growth names and into value names, and this rotation deepened the past few weeks with intense selling on the growth side. Today, for instance, was a strong rotation day, one of a handful we've seen over the past few weeks, with value outperforming growth by over 3%, a large spread for any single day. Energy and financials are the best performing sectors of the market so far in 2021, while tech stocks are lagging. For the year now, including today, value stocks are beating growth stocks by nearly 8%. Value hasn't outperformed growth since, no surprise, 2016. A couple theories on why we're seeing this rotation now. Valuations were too high in growth. This could be as simple as the market repositioning and rebalancing itself out of the leaders that are now expensive and into the value side of things. Two, rising rates and rising inflation are generally thought of as positive for value stocks. Financials for sure, as Doug mentioned, banks, and a negative for growth stocks. And three, the reopening timeline for the economy is accelerating, with all the positive news for vaccines, cases, et cetera, that we've seen with the pandemic. Value stocks are generally thought to perform better in these recovery and early stages of an economic cycle. This could be the market aligning itself with the reopening narrative and unwinding the work from home trade. This year could be very different than the past few years if this trend holds. I'll finish this section with a few data points of comparison to drive home these changing dynamics within the markets. Keep in mind, large cap growth stocks, plus 38% in 2020, minus 1% in 2021. Small cap value stocks, on the other hand, plus 4.6% in 2020, plus 17.5% in 2021. Tech stocks, plus 44% in 2020, and minus 1% in 2021. And energy stocks, minus 34% in 2020, and already plus 32% in 2021. It's no doubt the favored sectors and corners of the market are shifting as of now. This is a development to continue to monitor as we move through the year to see whether the rotation continues to take hold and strengthen. This will go a long way to explaining equity performance for 2021. And now, quickly to hit on fixed income. For 2021, the broad fixed income market is down for the year by about 2.5%. This is pretty much all due to rising interest rates. The 10-year Treasury yield has moved from 0.93% to start the year to 1.47% today. And as we know, bond prices move inversely to bond yields. This increase in yield is related to rising inflation expectations. Inflation expectations have risen throughout the year. The five-year break-even inflation rate sits at 2.45% today, the highest reading since 2011. We'll be keeping a close eye on inflation during the year as it has the potential to impact investing. Given the low starting yields and the anticipated economic recovery and likely rise in inflation, bonds were at a really tough starting point in 2021 after two very strong years. So this is looking like a difficult short-term period for bondholders. However, keep in mind that rising rates signal a healthy economy and can ultimately be better for investors to reinvest at those higher yields and better valuations. With that, I'll pass to Tom Bowling, who has the current data on COVID, the vaccine rollout, and some planning thoughts for the year. Tom.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. Good stuff. So we were reflecting back earlier this week on our initial call in March of 2020, and at the time, scrambling, as we all were, to get informed as it relates to the pandemic, its transmission, the risks that we all faced individually and collectively. And over the past year, it's been woven into our practice to understand the science behind this virus and in a way that would help inform us from an investor perspective, understand the economic ripple effects and when we might be able to see a light at the end of the tunnel. We all stand here today feeling confident that that light is shining bright at the end of the tunnel. Since the ramp up of the vaccine, the first vaccine from Pfizer was approved in December 11th of 2020. Obviously, took some time to ramp up. Then we had the holiday period with some gatherings. We had a caseload that spiked on January 8th of this year with 312,000 cases on January 8th. Fast forward to today, or yesterday, I should say, that the total case count as of yesterday on a daily basis was 54,000. We've seen an 82% reduction in daily case counts. And more importantly, the 7-day moving average has been reduced by 74%. That's a very encouraging trend. And that has translated into the lowest level of COVID hospitalizations that we've seen since midsummer. At the same time, with a diminishing caseload, we are seeing an improvement in vaccine distribution. We had a new high in terms of vaccines administered on February 26, just last week, of almost 2.5 million doses, which is very, very encouraging. We now have a third vaccine coming online from Johnson & Johnson, so we would only expect these numbers to improve. When I referenced that light at the end of the tunnel, we're all focused on this whole concept of herd immunity. That is a combination of those that have been exposed to COVID and recovered and those that have been vaccinated. It's widely considered that we can reach herd immunity once at least 70% of the population has been either exposed or vaccinated. As we stand today, almost 52 million people across the country have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. When you combine that number with the total amount of individuals that have been diagnosed with COVID of 28.5 million, we're at roughly 80 million people that have either been vaccinated or exposed to the virus. Most scientists believe that the total case count is woefully understated, given the fact that there's a lot of asymptomatic cases out there that never get diagnosed. It's not unreasonable to think that the caseload is probably at least double what's been reported. If we're conservative and we say 51 million have been vaccinated, 29 million have been exposed to the virus, increase that number by 20 million, we have 100 million people currently with some level of immunity. In order to get the 70% figure, that would require 200 million or another 100 million in the U.S. to either be vaccinated or exposed. Based on our current rate of vaccination of 1.5 million doses administered per day, we think it's not unrealistic to expect that some level of herd immunity will be achieved in just 60 days. In the first or second week of May, we feel strongly that that 200 million threshold will be reached. So again, extremely encouraging figures. And like we said, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which has a much easier path of distribution, will only improve these figures. One of the most telling signs of where we've come in this COVID pandemic, and this is just anecdotal, one of our main sources of data is a website called the COVID Data Tracking Project. They have announced that they're going to suspend their COVID tracking as of next week, based on the fact that the data is improving, the need for that resource has diminished. Certainly the CDC and other government agencies have picked up the slack, but we found that to be very interesting that the one of the main sources of comprehensive data is no longer going to publish that information as of March 7th. So again, all encouraging signs. So just as the pandemic has had economic ripple effects throughout the last year, we are anticipating some policy ripple effects. And I'm going to transition here now to go through some financial planning ideas and considerations that we all should be thinking about. First, let me start with, seasonality-wise, here we sit in the first quarter of the calendar year. It's always a great time to think through your budget, whether you're in the accumulation phase or what we call the distribution phase of retirement. Budgeting is the main pillar that we have when it comes to financial planning. Back to the imagery of the ripple effect, one of the biggest ripple effects we've seen from an economic perspective is the savings rate. The savings rate across the U.S. spiked in March and April of last year up to 34%, the highest we've ever seen. That savings rate currently stands at 15%, which is twice the historic average of 7.5%. What that tells us is there's a lot of cash on the sidelines, a lot of pent-up demand, individuals that are anticipating and waiting to spend those dollars. Back to the pre or the accumulation phase versus the distribution phase. If you're in the accumulation phase and you find yourself having accumulated a lot of cash at a high savings rate, we would encourage you to reflect on where you are in terms of your retirement goals and prioritizing funding retirement vehicles prior to consumption. A good metric for those accumulating is if you can save anywhere from 10 to 15% of your income on an annual basis, puts you on a great path to achieving your long-term retirement goals. So again, in this first quarter, consider increasing 401k contributions, making IRA contributions, HSAs, paying down debt, things of that nature. Pay yourself first with these extra funds. For those that are already in retirement, frankly, it might be a time to accelerate some spending. We've had good markets. You've had over a year of probably increased savings. You know, with the crux of a financial plan to support these decision points, you know, if there is an excess of asset accumulation, it might well be met with an increase in overall spending for a period of time. So, you know, next, back to kind of the policy ripple effects that we are anticipating, they really resonate around tax policy. We've had two plus a pending stimulus package introduced over the last year. We've had a change in the administration. We've done a lot of spending at the government level to shepherd us along through this pandemic. It's only natural to think that there's going to be some tax implications moving forward to bridge the deficit gap. We think that's going to manifest in two ways. Number one, on personal income rates. The Biden administration has certainly expressed a desire to increase the top marginal tax rates. Just to give you some perspective, the current top tax rate is 37%. Once you incorporate the Medicare surcharge of 3.8, the top marginal tax rate gets us to 40.8%. The average top tax rate over history since 1924 has been 57%. So we're at historic lows on a relative basis from a tax perspective, and at a time where we need to generate some revenue. It's only natural to think that these top rates are going to go up. The current tax policy will sunset in 2026. However, we think that there'll be changes prior to that. So what can we be doing from a planning perspective to optimize our outcomes based on an expectation that tax rates are going to go up? Well, a few things. Number one, Roth conversions. All of us have done a great job accumulating dollars in pre-tax IRAs and 401ks. Now is the time to at least consider pulling forward some income in the form of converting some of those pre-tax dollars to an after-tax vehicle like a Roth. That means realizing income today for the benefit of tax-free growth in the future. Again, done in the context of a total financial plan, we can figure out, you know, how much and when to execute when it comes to a Roth conversion. The second piece is be very tax aware when it comes to investing. Take advantage of tax loss harvesting. Invest in a way that is long-term focused in protecting long-term capital gains. There's a lot that can be done. Not only when we think about rates of return and investing, there's a few components that we can control: fees and taxes. And so we're really focused on both of those, especially now managing the tax side of the investment return. A couple other things: bunching deductions. If we find yourself in a standard filing situation, think about consolidating some of your deductions in a certain year, whether it be charitable or otherwise, and then moving forward with a standard filing post that bunching period. And then last piece, if you're in the accumulation phase, consider siphoning off some of your contribution to a 401k into a Roth 401k. Like we said, if you're in a lower tax situation now than you might anticipate being in the future, that's a good trade-off. The last thing I'll point to in terms of these policy ripple effects is centered around estate planning. The current estate tax exemption for each individual is $11,700,000. So for a married couple, almost $24 million that you can pass free of estate tax to your beneficiaries. The current administration is on record proposing to reduce that estate tax exemption to $3.5 million per individual, so for a total estate of $7 million. Coupled with life insurance, that brings a lot more people into a taxable estate scenario. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen on that front. The current rules are set to sunset in 2025. In addition to an adjustment in the estate tax exemption, there is some consideration of raising the estate tax rate from 40% to 45%. So there are a number of things that we can do to mitigate that risk moving forward. What's great is through a comprehensive financial plan, we can begin to quantify what your estate will look like in the future using reasonable inputs for spending and rates of return and longevity. If there's an identification of an estate tax problem, there's plenty of strategies that can be instituted on a gradual basis to slowly reduce the value of your estate. And typically that involves targeting high growth assets, such as an interest in the small business, some gifting strategies, et cetera. So plenty to be thinking about, again, as we evaluate the economic ripple effect into other areas, in specifically in financial planning. There's a lot to be thinking of as we move through the course of this year. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Doug just to kick off the Q&A.
Thanks, guys. Tom always makes us refer to him as Dr. Bowling the day before and after each client conference call. So well done, Doc. So if anyone has a question, we invite you to press *9 and it will alert us to your interest in asking. While we wait for that, I'm going to read a question that was sent in by a client earlier today that was unable to be on the call. He said, I've read a lot about SPACs. It seems like every morning on CNBC, they're interviewing someone about a new SPAC. What is a SPAC? It's a great question. It's something that kind of hit the lexicon or was renewed in the investment lexicon last summer and has only gained popularity. So a SPAC, first of all, that's an acronym, and it stands for Special Purpose Acquisition Company. They're also known in the financial press as blank check companies, and they are essentially a shell company that is set up by investors with the sole purpose of raising money through an IPO, an initial public offering, to eventually acquire another company, right? So what ends up happening is investor groups or companies raise capital with the purpose of generally deploying that capital without a specific designation in mind when the capital is raised. They have been absolutely prolific this year, as I mentioned, with interest rates as low as they are, and the enthusiasm that such inexpensive capital tends to generate. Many new companies have been launched that are looking for a catapult or a springboard to take them to the next level of prosperity. SPACs themselves have begun competing with other SPACs. It is a race to deploy capital that's already been raised, and it undeniably could be creating an alignment between price and value. Interestingly, to attract interest in SPACs, they've
brought on certain degrees of star power. People like Billy Beane of Moneyball and Oakland A's general management fame. A-Rod and Paul Ryan have all launched SPACs with backing from financial engineers as they hope their expertise in areas that made them famous will attract potential candidates in which they can invest capital. We are not a large, by and large, a fan of the concept, only in so much as it is very aspirational. John used the term cash flow discounting to come up with something called a net present value. That might sound as complicated as SPACs competing with SPACs, but the reality is what John was describing is evidentiary, not aspirational, in trying to ascertain a reasonable value for an investment. So we think it's kind of an interesting concept. We think it is something that happens when there is a lot of money that's well-intended but without specificity, and it frankly makes us very nervous, and we've yet to find a place in client portfolios for them to be included. Do we have any questions yet, Tony?
No questions currently. There was one other question that was submitted prior to tonight's call, and it was just a general question about cryptocurrencies. You know, as much as SPACs have been in the news, certainly we've all read and heard a lot about Bitcoin, and I feel like more so every day. The question is, what is our view on cryptocurrencies? How do they or should they be involved in client portfolios? You know, back to kind of the imagery of the ripple effect of the pandemic, we feel like the cryptocurrency landscape is certainly a beneficiary, for lack of a better term, of this ripple effect. Number one, there's lots of cash out there. We already referenced the high rate of savings amongst individuals the last 12 months. Couple that with the fact that there is a lot of concern about the fiat currencies given a high rate of spending amongst our governments around the world. And third, just some general aspirational elements of the momentum behind seeing these cryptocurrencies increase in price seemingly on a daily basis. That tends to attract additional capital in a bit of a frenzy. So that has led a lot of investors to pour capital into the space. There's no doubt that there's some long-term functionality of both the blockchain and perhaps cryptocurrencies in general. It's very, very difficult for us as investors to identify those that are going to retain value, and just given the levels of volatility that exist in the space, it's not prudent for us to want to carve out a specific allocation to that asset class. But certainly something that we're going to continue to monitor as it becomes more mainstream and there's more investment vehicles that are developed, might be something to consider down the road.
And I actually had one more too, Tommy. I'll kick it to John to answer. But a client sent a question and said, "What is a short squeeze? And what did people who profited in the short squeeze of GameStop and AMC do wrong? I mean, is it legal?" Johnny, do you want to take that question?
Sure. So, first part, what is a short squeeze? First, what is shorting? So shorting stock is when you have the opinion that the price is going to go down. And so one way to reflect that opinion is to borrow the shares from someone else and sell them to someone else with the intent to buy them back at a lower price and return the shares to the person you borrowed them from. So it's very prevalent in the hedge fund industry to short stocks. And in this case, GameStop was a very heavily shorted stock. The short interest was as high as any other stock on the market. And in the case of a short squeeze, it's when you have when you have a stock that is heavily shorted and the price begins to rise, that goes against the person, or the, in this case, the hedge fund that was shorting the stock. And so it makes their position lose value. And the key difference between a short and long position to think about from a risk management perspective is, you know, with a long position, your risk is 100% loss. The stock can go to zero. With a short position, your risk is unlimited. The stock can double, triple, or in the case of GameStop, go up 10 times what it was worth. And also with a short position, as the position starts working against you, it gets bigger, as opposed to in a long position, it gets smaller. So as the stock starts going up and your position starts to lose value, your risk only increases, and it only becomes worse and worse for the fund. So that's what the people at Reddit, and they identified, really at the start of it, it was an honest evaluation of a company that the market hated. It had very little prospects as a brick and mortar retailer in an industry that had completely changed video games. And it did not have much prospects. So they identified it as a very deep value opportunity. And the fact that it had a high level of short interest was a technical part of the stock story that just kind of boosted their case for the investment. And you know, from what happened from there, where everybody kind of piled in and Robinhood opened however million accounts they opened in a week, of people just throwing money at it and just wanting the stock to go up to kind of stick it to the Wall Street hedge fund. At that point, it kind of jumped the shark to a whole different story.
But nothing illegal.
No, nothing illegal. I mean, there is something illegal about going out on a message board and pumping up a stock to manipulate it.
That's right.
And to sell it later at a profit. These people really, I mean, I think you have to give them some credit, which was really tough for a lot of pundits to do on CNBC, but you have to give them credit for the analysis they do. If you go in the forums, they do their work. And I don't know if people saw the testimony in front of Congress from the Roaring Kitty, was the pseudonym of the investor that started all this. I mean, he knows his stuff, and he really did a lot of work on it. And you know, up until the point that every kind of random teenager or just general person wanted to jump in and ride the stock upwards, it was a legitimate, interesting story.
It's really changed that.
Yeah, so again, it's star 9 to ask a question. I think there was a little hiccup with our technology, but there was a question that just came in that I'm going to have Doug touch on. But the question is, can you talk to the increase in the money supply, the buildup of the Fed balance sheet, and how that impacts inflation moving forward?
Yeah, that is it's a concern, but I would probably put it as a tertiary concern at the Fed and the Treasury, with the expectation that the growth that they're trying to catalyze by flooding the market with money will ultimately offer an offset in the amount of economic activity that will be undertaken that will generate revenue to pay back the debt. Now, that is a very simplistic and almost Pollyannish view of what needs to take place. But I think that the inflation that we're seeing can work both beneficially, but then if it goes too far, can work at cross purposes. Right? Our government is funding a very large part of underlying economic activity. That is not a sound long-term strategy. It is not founded in free market capitalism. It was an intervention provided in an emergency fashion that many, many critics think has gone too far. And that's somewhat hard to argue. But when you have the amount of dollars in the system, which the Fed now has injected through the conduit of the Treasury, right? Think about what's happening. the government is trading bonds for cash. So the Treasury issues bonds. The Fed provides money into the system so they can be purchased. And then those dollars are in the system. The dollars are only in the system as a mechanism to create a multiplier effect of underlying economic activity. In its absence, paying that back will be inordinately difficult. If it's too efficacious and prices run amok, meaning we have hyperinflation, then the government is going to have a very hard time floating additional debt on a shorter term basis and being able to pay back the Treasury. So it's very precarious, and we certainly feel like the attention of both the Federal Reserve Bank and now Janet Yellen, who's the Secretary of Treasury, formerly the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, are tuned in to those risks. We are hopeful and we feel confident that they understand the severity should that needle, which is not as narrow as I think some people would like to believe, isn't threaded. So there is a wide berth of prosperity that is available if the economy produces the type of growth that is in sort of the base case of how they're laying it out with the anticipation that it'll be forthcoming. So is it problematic as it relates to inflation? Absolutely. Is it going to be remedied if we can get growth ample, the marginal taxes out of a volume of activity to pay it back? That's the goal. Hopefully that will be sustained. And as it plays out, if we hit some of the growth trajectories that people are anticipating, it will give the Fed cover needed to reduce the size of the balance sheet, to take money out of the system and put their balance sheet on a little bit firmer footing. We just got a question that was emailed to us. And the question is there an opportunity in securities lending? In a prior capacity, this client had referenced they made quite a bit of money doing that. And I'm not sure, I mean...
It kind of ties into the whole concept of shorting stocks, right? If you afford your portfolio the ability to, or your shares to be lent out, there is a rate to be paid to the investor who is allowing their shares to be lent. I don't know if that functionality, Doug, is available at Schwab or TD Ameritrade or our main custodians, but something we can look into.
I don't believe it's available on the institutional side for clients of our type. It's more on what's called a prime brokerage relationship, where that capital is on deposit and not in a company or individual name, but thrown into a lending pool. And that would be then probably a privilege that would extend to the custodian as opposed to the client. But we can absolutely check into that.
At this time, there are no more questions in the queue. Let's go ahead and wrap for this evening.
Yeah, so thank you again for joining us. Thank you again for your trust and your confidence and your friendship as clients. We will definitely keep in close touch as we navigate through what is certain to be another fascinating year in the financial market. And have a fantastic evening. If you're in Kansas City, whatever of this amazing weather day is left, I hope you can go out and enjoy it. Thank you again.